Excellent. We're up and racing. This is the first McLuhan on Maui or Mamba event. It's the Monday night seminars or colloquia for the Global Village / Theatre / Membrane. This evening we've got Bob Dobbs as the inaugural guest of honour to himself. We've got participants from around the world. The date in Northern America is the 28th of February. We're beginning at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Here in New Zealand, it's the 1st of March, 2011. So take it away, Bob. We're excited that you can set us in motion.
Okay, just a minute. Okay, so let's see.
Now you're too
it's late. Actually technically 5 to 8 Eastern Standard Time, just to be precise. Okay, I'm going to go to page 197 of the Interior Landscape book, the collection of literary criticism of McLuhan from 1943 to 1962. And there's an essay he did in 1945-46 called The Southern Quality. And he makes this statement, which I've never heard anybody talk about. He says, the vigor, this is on page 196, going to the top of 197 of the hard copy edition. The vigor, this is McLuhan saying, writing about the Southern tradition, the Jeffersonian concept of democracy, the south of the Mason-Dixon line, so to speak, the vigor, quote, the vigor of the aristocratic idea in the 19th century South probably explains how Edgar Allan Poe, alone of his age, forecast the effect of the machine on the forms of human life, on the very notion, so he forecast the effect of the machine on the very notion of the person and on the forms of human life. That's saying that Edgar Allan Poe was the first media ecologist. Now, Andrew, have you ever heard anybody point that out?
That Poe is the first meteorologist? No.
Yeah, he's the lone of his age. He's the first to forecast the effect of the machine on the forms of human life, on the very notion of the person. That's pretty incredible, because most people, if they know McLuhan enough, they'll know that the story of the maelstrom, descent into the maelstrom, the story of the whirlpool, the sailors caught in the whirlpool, that was a major metaphor for McLuhan and led to an aspect of the tetrad known as retrieval, or his tetrad recovered the retrieval aspect from the famous story about the descent into the maelstrom. But the other thing, that Poe was the first to study the effects of the machine, I've never heard anybody say that. And that, it's really interesting to look at, where does Poe do that? Is the pit and the pendulum, that horror story, and the pendulum, you know, the pendulum is coming closer and closer to the guy tied down in the pit. Is that a symbolism of technology doing, and it's echoed in another famous McLuhan line, it goes something like, he's always amazed that humans throw themselves into the buzzsaw of technology without any concern. So the buzzsaw to me echoes the slicing pendulum. Have you guys all seen that movie, at least, or the story?
I read the book a long time ago, the story or whatever, a long time ago, though.
Right, so the pendulum is swinging closer and closer to his stomach. It's going to slice him as he's being kind of tortured
right,
or something.
Yeah, I remember vaguely.
And so when you think of, he talks about, McLuhan talks about technology being amputations. You could think of this pendulum, you know, if you rotated the body, amputate the eye, amputate the arm, amputate the legs, it has a horror level to it that is Poe-esque. And I find that really amazing. And I was thinking that the only other person credited with looking at the effects of technology is Mary Shelley, right, with Frankenstein, which was written just before, I think, Poe's world. Poe died in 1849, right when the telegraph shows up. But is McLuhan being a sexist here, and you know, and emphasizing Poe rather than than is her name Mary Shelley. But what's interesting is Shelley is talking about a scientist creating a little anthropomorphic cyborg that runs around and obliterates. It's not environmental, I don't think. The effects of science is an environment, and that may be what Poe did.
Bob, would you tell me a little bit more about Mary Shelley and what you're referring to?
Well, she's the one who wrote the novel Frankenstein.
Okay.
So the idea that a scientist would make a golem or something that would just wreak havoc in the village is often seen as the first science fiction paranoia about technology. Am I wrong on that, anybody?
I don't have enough knowledge of ancient or old stuff.
Yeah, it is ancient.
To me, it is, but you know, that's me. But, you know.
Well, she uses electricity to bring the creature to life, and you know, she has a whole laboratory of transistors, but tubed instruments or whatever that she was focusing all this. What's that phrase? Biology. What's the phrase? Biology is intelligence, or remember? You know what I'm talking about, Bob?
Who said it?
McLuhan. Is a biological event. Electricity is a biological.
Oh
event.
Yeah. Teilhard de Chardin said electricity is a biological event. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's using electricity as a biological event to bring this creature alive.
Right. Now, are you looking at the Wikipedia there right now?
No.
Okay. Can you see someone who's handy look up the date of her story? And then we can see when Poe did Pit and the Pendulum. But anyways, McLuhan's going to go with the guy, probably, than the woman. And McLuhan never was – he studied romantic poetry, but he didn't identify with the romantic poets. He identified with the symbolists, starting with Baudelaire – in the 1850s. It's interesting that The Flowers of Evil, Baudelaire's classic book of poetry, came out in 1857, and McLuhan made his book, Verbi Vocal Visual Explorations, be in the centennial of that, 1957. But Poe was a big influence on the symbolists. And so McLuhan's going to go with the symbolist thread, symbolist tradition, more than the romantics. So, but it's an interesting point to discuss whether it's environmental that Poe is talking about, the effects of technology. Because a feminist would see that sentence probably, or anybody, but, you know, a feminist would say, wait a minute, first effects, you know, Mary Shelley did it. But what are the effects on the notion of a person? I don't know if the idea of Frankenstein is affecting people's ideas of the notion of the person. They're just running around scared and making sure he didn't kill them.
So, isn't it interesting how famous it is, though, Bob? I mean, everybody, I mean, even, you know, this woman that didn't know who Mary Shelley was knew exactly what Frankenstein was as soon as you said it. I mean, it's like, you know, it's
more archetypal than Poe. It's
right.
More stereotypical cliché. I mean,
well, it got
carried
forward into the movie environment and then into the TV environment because I saw the movie on TV when I was a kid repeatedly.
Yeah,
right.
You never saw The Pit and the Pendulum.
I saw that, too.
Oh, I did, too, as a movie. I don't know Poe's work that well. I don't know all his other stories. I don't know how many other horror stories. Anybody know Poe?
I read a lot of them when I was younger, but I don't remember all the details. He wrote some weird shit, though.
Yeah, he was considered... It's if you look at the editor of this collection... At the beginning of the third part that this Poe essay I'm quoting from is in, he says, Poe, therefore, freed from the narrow critical strictures of doctrinaire a priori critical assumptions, in brackets, obsessed with the abnormal, in quotes, the morbid, in quotes, etc. So we would call that the Gothic nowadays, right?
Right. So he was way ahead of his time.
Yeah. And this guy, he is the one writing this, is Eugene McNamara, fellow professor of McLuhan. He organized the collection, and he did pick really good essays. He says, Poe, therefore, freed from those assumptions, can be seen as a political writer, as perhaps the only American writer of his time who was firmly and deeply involved in the American tradition. Now, the larger reference for this sentence is the ancient quarrel in modern America between the southern tradition, which came from one part of Europe, tended to see more of the feudal agrarian world, and then the other tradition, which was known as the moderny tradition or the moderns. It comes from the Sorbonne in Paris and is in, centered in Harvard, New England. So the difference is that the South is not infatuated with technology, technology being machines, as much as the North is. So here's a statement in another essay in the collection called Edgar Poe's Tradition. McLuhan says, the work of Werner Sombart on the economic plane makes the same point. Scholastic philosophy and theology, that is the Sorbonne, New England, Harvard tradition. So Harvard picked up their stuff from one strain of European culture, and the South picked up the other, the more aristocratic, agrarian, feudal. So McLuhan says, scholastic philosophy and theology, that's the modern tradition, provided the indispensable viewpoint and technological abstraction which brought about the rise of industrial capitalism. The Southern resistance to technology in an industry and industry is inherent, just as the Northern passion for machinery and bureaucracy is inherent in age-old but divergent intellectual traditions. Now, he goes on to say that the Southern tradition, the Southern character, which is one of passion and not so much of abstraction and thinking, it's passion, involvement in the daily life, and what's another characteristic? And also fatalistic. Some might say, well, they're round animals, farm animals, so they have a, you know, they see the life and death pattern stronger. I don't know if that's a cliche by a northerner myself, but the point is that McLuhan is talking about, in this essay, The Southern Tradition, he's the first to really talk about the atomic bomb in critical discourse. He's writing this after seeing the explosion in August 45, and it's an incredible essay where he talks about the implications for arts and culture and how they'd all become useless, and even artists would have too big of an ego to handle the new corporate, anonymous, global police state that the atomic bomb brought in. And he's saying that the Southern quality, the Southern understanding of fatalism and having a passion for light and not getting involved in worshiping new technologies. I was looking at this the other day and thinking about how McLuhan really, he's seen by critics as someone favoring the Southern tradition as opposed to the Northern. But if you actually look at this, he's describing the effects of the atomic bomb, and the most appropriate mental, emotional stance is to put on the Southern mask, and then you'll be better able to handle that bleak effect that the bomb had in the late 40s and early 50s. And then he starts talking differently in the 60s because it's a different technological environment, a new ground, television, computers, and satellites. And therefore, the idea that he favors the South may not be a permanent thing. It may have been a strategic position to take in the 40s because the Southern writers and critical ferment was more attractive to intellectuals if they wanted to get on the latest bandwagon. But McLuhan covered his ass because he was talking about this is the way it is when it's atomic bombs. So it's almost like McLuhan saying, I will join you Southern guys for a while because you have the right mask, social mask, and social instincts for a deadly, fatalistic situation where humans are obsolete due to the atomic bomb. I'll hang out with you for a while. Those guys are puzzled by the later McLuhan, who doesn't seem to have any opinions and writings and ideas that relate to what he wrote in the 40s. So, Andrew, don't you think this is interesting to look at the – and I'm addressing Andrew since he's the PhD, and he's well-versed in this stuff. Some of you may not have – probably haven't read these early essays. Andrew, isn't that interesting to point out that the Southern quality appears to be favored by McLuhan because he sees it as an appropriate response to the atomic bomb?
Yeah, that's a pretty long-range view of what he's up to, Bob, like in terms of McLuhan's own self-awareness of where he's at, you know, in the 40s and 50s. But, yeah, I can roll with that for now.
Yeah, because here he is. He's talking about the effect of the machine on the forms of life. Now, McLuhan will be known 20 years later. This is 46. In 66-67, he'll become popularized as the strange person from Mars who actually looked at the effects of machines. And, of course, they didn't have the background that he had in Harold Innes and all that stuff. But the thing is, he's seen as a revolutionary character, and he's stating 20 years before the tradition and how it comes from Poe, and that he wouldn't be the first. You see, that's pretty neat. He's saying Poe understood the medium was the message.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting point. Now,
Poe was heralding the industrial age, not the electronic age so much.
Well, he died in 1849.
Yeah, so what do you mean? He's not heralding it. He's warning about it.
Yeah, but I'm just making a distinction that we're talking about the industrial age here.
Right. No, that's a good.
Warned about it too.
No, that's a good point. That we don't know what level of technology he's seeing. You know what I mean? Yeah, it could be industry. Is maybe electricity is considered? The telegraph is considered part of industry? I don't know. That's something to look into if you can find in his writings. But probably you're right. It seems that. The guy who wrote The House of the Seven Gables, is that Melville?
Yeah.
Melville, I think. He, in about 1851 or so, he writes this amazing quote that the telegraph now creates a global membrane. He almost uses the word nervous system. He understands the effect of the telegraph in creating the situation we're in now more intensely here on this phone conference call. He actually talks about electricity as a membrane, and that's just a couple of years after Poe died. So he might be the one who sees the electrical effect first, but I don't know if you can say that about Poe.
Yeah,
so,
and when was that, Bob?
When was what?
The House of the Seven Gables.
1851. If anybody's good at Googling it, maybe Deb is, just put it in a wiki and you get the date. I think it's 1851, and Poe dies in 1849.
Mm-hmm.
So if any, I mean, Chad's good, whoever can make that precise. But here's the, okay, so that's the second point, the larger picture of Poe and how McLuhan was maybe adopting. See, I'm saying, Andrew, because he was talking about the effects of the machine that early, what he was known to be developing later, after Mechanical Bride realized that TV changed everything and it was shocked and went into private study, discovered Innes, and then figured, oh, this is what I should talk about. No, he knows that he's on the media ecological path. He doesn't have that actual word, you know, by 46. And that, you don't publish when you're in that day, you know, until you've got it figured out for a couple years. So you can look back at how he started to see this in the late 30s and 40s, and his whole PhD is about the effect of the printing press on why dialectics took over in the 1700s and stopped the southern rhetorical tradition or the agrarian feudal tradition in Europe. In larger terms, it's the acoustic space of the south versus the visual fetishism of the north.
With the rise of mathematics in the 9th century, which is the tactile.
Right, let's just see who's coming in, new or old.
It's Mish.
Hey,
hey, how are you?
Hey, it's Michelle. Now, this is Michelle Mose is calling from Atlanta area, and Michelle grew up in Toronto beside Wychwood Park, and his father was a friend of McLuhan. And Michelle, by way of introduction, tell us your last time with McLuhan.
Oh, when I did a magic show for him.
Yeah, tell him the context. Why did you see that?
Yeah, no, that was pretty awesome. We were in high school then. We were young. But McLuhan had already had his stroke, so he couldn't speak. But he came over to dinner with Corinne and one of the girls.
This would be around 79 Christmas.
Yep, just right there. Yep, that's about right. And it was quite magical because at the time, my brother and I, we would entertain dinner guests afterwards in the parlor, you know, with magic, sleight of hand, close-up magic, that sort of thing. Nothing too big because, you know, it wasn't stage size. It was just the living room. But what was really amazing was that we were able to communicate nonverbally with Marshall. And he wasn't able to speak, but he was able to squeeze Corinne's hand, and there was a real twinkle in his eye, you know. So we could tell that he really enjoyed it, and Corinne told us as well that he really liked it. So I just always thought that was a rather sort of special thing at the end there. You know?
Yeah, because this your house was on the border of Witchwood Park?
No, we're nearby. You know,
nearby.
Moreover, yeah, we're sort of on the other side of the annex. But, you know, in Toronto terms, it's around the corner, you know.
Right. And did your father publish the Carol Appel book that McLuhan did the foreword for?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, because your father was an art publisher in the Yorkville art world
in
Toronto.
Yeah, he's an art dealer. He's an art dealer, but he also did, he kind of pioneered the idea of the, you know, the single volume, sort of art volume. So he put together that book on Carl Appel. And I remember when Appel and McLuhan were at the house for that. So that was neat. You know,
you remember Appel and McLuhan together at your home?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Carol Appel, Appel, was a famous artist and evoked a lot of interesting statements from McLuhan when he was talking about Appel. And I think it was Appel, he said, always wanted to do a play. And he said, Marshall, you write the script and I'll make the stage sets. I know you got a play in your being, in yourself.
Right.
And so the hidden dramatic part of McLuhan, that he was a playwright and playing and saw the media as being characters on the global theater stage, Carol Appel brought out the potential of McLuhan doing that. And I don't know, Andrew's been in the archives, I don't know if that script was ever done. McLuhan did do a script in the 50s, but did you see anything in the 70s, Andrew?
For
Carol Appel doing something with McLuhan?
No, there's McLuhan's reviews of his works, but there's no, I don't think there's, from memory, there's no evidence of a collaboration.
Yeah, if you look in the good, very excellent Forces magazine put out by Quebec Hydro, there's a really great interview in there, and I think it's in there that he talks about Carol Appel. And the point is, it's just the notion of him doing a play, and he says it's triggered by Carol Appel, he will then say all these other ideas around that. So the ideas that he says, based on the notion of doing a play, is maybe more interesting than a play. And that's why the interviews are good to read.
Yeah, well, that you kind of hit on the thing. It's sort of maddening because McLuhan was sort of able to kind of take somebody's whole work and say something even more interesting than all of their body of work in just a short story. You know, like everybody knows about his review of Naked Lunch, right?
Yes.
Yeah, which is brilliant, and it makes Burroughs look really good. But I just came across recently in a correspondence where he writes to somebody and says that, well, you know, Burroughs is not really that smart. He doesn't act, he reacts, you know. So he didn't even think that highly of it. But when you read the review, you're like, wow. I'll
go
back and read Burroughs.
That's right. There's a lot. Now, that's what McLuhan said. The problem with Burroughs is he's reacting and not acting. That's what you're quoting?
Yeah.
That's a whole other topic that we're going to get into at some point, maybe not tonight, but that's really a key point, because if you read that review very subtly, he's criticizing Burroughs for panicking about being a mediocologist, and McLuhan takes a stance of not being a mediocologist in that essay, which is a pretty interesting strategy.
Yeah. It was nice, too. He didn't pan him. He supported him.
He said Burroughs was only the only one recognizing the problem and continuing the tradition of Joyce. But I want to finish the story about you, Michelle, is that here you have this, you know, teenager doing magic, pretty good accomplished magic tricks for McLuhan, and he's observing it. And McLuhan defined, you know, technological change as magic, as alchemy. The initial magical phenomenon is what Marshall wrote about all his life. He was always looking at magic. He talked about the action of your senses as magical. So I think it's pretty poetic that McLuhan, one of the final things he sees is some kid doing magic at him. That is an icon of him studying all environments as magical.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it sort of sounds, I don't know,
kind of makes me think of Phatic Communion or something like that, you know?
Yes, yeah. He has a great line in the 1950s, and I'm going to cite essays as I remember them, just for, this is for scholars too, to listen to this series and will speed up their learning, is in 1954 he talks about the magical casements of being. Or, Andrew, did I leave out the word windows? Windows on the magical casements of being. Do you know that phrase?
Oh, yeah, that rings
yes.
a bell.
Anyways, that's a good phrase, and note how he uses magical in reference to the action of perception. He used to always like to refer to the flipping of the eyeball. You know, you'd flip the image when it went into yourself, according to optics
right.
or something.
Right.
Okay, so the next, you missed the first part, Michelle, and we might come
yeah.
back to it, but the next level, the final thing, I'm the guest of honor tonight, Michelle, so I'm just presenting something, then you guys can tear it apart or whack off to it, whatever. The thing is that the next level I move to is the essence of dramatic fiction, thriller stories, making stories. If you were asked to make a TV sitcom or make a detective show or a thriller show, you would use, in the end, you'd use the tetrad. Because the basic plot in any sitcom, and I've rediscovered this watching Fringe and Lost and these really good TV shows the last couple of years, because I hadn't watched TV for 30 years, and it reminded me of this process. McLuhan said that Poe discovered the technique of writing a story, and he's the one, McLuhan says, invented the detective story, of leaving things out. In other words, the traditional view of stories, you tell a story and you lead them along till the great punchline. But Poe decided to leave things out and write the story backwards. He was going for the effect or the mystery being solved in a detective in his way of writing a story, which became called a detective story. And McLuhan theorized that journalists like Charles Dickens and Poe discovered that because they had to serialize their columns in the newspapers and know where they were going, but they couldn't tell the whole story each column. So they had to think ahead differently than someone writing a poem or a normal prose story in the 1700s or 1800s. The point is that it's knowing what to leave out. So if you take it, what is a thriller story or a detective story? Something is extended. There's people walking around living, and then someone's killed. A situation is created, a dramatic new environment with new effects on the people. And it obsolesces what everybody was doing as they run around reacting to the new crisis, problem, or situation. Then what happens is, as the story's unfolding, you start to get towards a solution when something is retrieved. And you see this in Lost and all that, or in the TV series 24. Jack Bauer get himself in a weird situation. He's going to be killed. No way he's going to get out of it. And then some woman that he met, 40 minutes before, who you've forgotten about, is retrieved, and she's over in the corner and snipes off the guy who's going to kill Jack Bauer. She's retrieved. And the normal way of writing the fiction is you write along and you say a bunch of things, then you move into other scenario and you hope the reader forgets about what you said or who you dropped into the beginning of the story. And then you retrieve them and it flips into a surprise ending, which is usually finding out that the murderer killed his mother and didn't know it, right? It's always a family connection. That's a particular aspect I've explored with other people. But here's the thing. The tetrad, what you enhance, what you obsolesce, what you retrieve, and what you flip into, is the basic model for memory, for consciousness, and for writing a TV show. That's what you do. So that's a pretty interesting point that Marshall, as a professor of literature, hit on the formula for making any kind of fiction in pop culture. So that's my presentation. Have at me.
Yeah, that's the linear tetrad, Bob.
That's the linear tetrad. Yeah, if you take the eye, it's a good point, because the tetrad is all happening at the same time. But it's all happening at the same time in the writer's mind. He then spreads it out on the printed page and makes it linear. But the hidden action is the simultaneous tetrad. That's the ground of fiction. All you have to do if you want to write TV shows is just have something happen. That's a new environment. And what is already been seen gets forgotten. And then there's another factor that you retrieve, that you plant in there somewhere and then retrieve later as part of your solution. And now in the Playboy interview, McLuhan says that he building on Joyce, Eliot, Pound, and Lewis, and Yeats, had figured out the process and identity of the stages of creation, or say it this way, the identity of the process of creation. So he's claiming that he knows the creative, he knows how people are creative. And in the century of the Electric Age, he said the 20th century was so much creativity that creativity was a cliche. So as a scientist, he laid out the process of creativity, how you make something to be content in a world where cultures are business. That is what he was exposing. He was exposing the process of creativity not only in the environmental level, but in private literary terms. So I think
cliche,
that's...
Does cliche to archetype process?
That's exactly what it is. Barry Nevitt wrote once that consciousness is the interplay of cliche archetype. But McLuhan would add, you know, the extension and the flip. Now, the retrieval aspect in the Poe story of the descent into the maelstrom is these two sailors are out there, they're brothers, storm comes up, the boat's in trouble. One brother ties himself to the masthead, you know, freezes himself in one position, and he's dragged down by the boat when it sinks. But the other brother notices that the barrel and refuse that's fallen off the boat is swirling around in the storm's whirlpool, and he notices that every now and then a barrel that goes down into the black hole pops back up. So he jumped and grabbed onto one of those barrels and went down and up and popped down and went back up, did that process and was saved. You can see that he saw the retrieval factor. And the retrieval factor is probably the one thing that Hegel didn't get in his synthesis of dialectical transformation. The retrieval aspect is really key, and that's really developed in the book from cliche to archetype. So I just want to finish talking. Anybody, you can ignore what I said, go into anything else. This is for everybody to talk. So someone else. Brian, what do you think? Or what do you want to talk about? Now, Brian may have popped off. He sometimes, where he is, he disconnects and has to come back. So either he's on mute or he's not.
I'll interject here, Bob. Do you see, like you said, retrieval as a figure? But in a certain sense, the retrieval can be deemed as a much stronger force in the sense that it's like the reverse spiral that goes back up the vortex. It's the thing that keeps the vortex alive and going as what the anti-gravitational pull. The fact that it doesn't all just disappear down a hole at once all in one instant.
Well, that is what Poe discovered, that something that goes down pops back up.
I mean,
I'm just saying there's the total force going back the other way.
Well, that would be the Phoenix myth that Joyce uses in Finnegan's Wake, right? The Phoenix rebirth?
No, I was more meaning it's like the countervailing spin, you know? It's like instead of the forward spin, it's the back spin. It's the at the level the same power and magnitude as that which causes the spin down, almost independent of the objects, the water casket or any other bits of shrapnel that are floating around in that thing.
Well, Barry Nevitt used to call the tetrad rim spin. So you had back spin, front spin, and maybe a couple other spins. So is that what you're just emphasizing retrieval? It's one of the spins, but you're making it the main force?
Or a force as that parallels a main force as opposed to a figure. Well, I mean, that's another way of looking at it, although I guess traditionally it's looked at as a figure.
Okay,
right.
Just a second now. We're getting some interference on Brian's line, like some sibilance and...
That's Andrew.
Oh, sorry, Andrew. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's Andrew's on Skype, so he might. It's up to Andrew to modulate how he's audible or not. What do you think, Andrew?
At this stage, I'll just have to be inaudible. But next time, I should be.
No, you're okay. There's just a little bit of sibilant.
Are you walking around with your laptop or something, Andrew?
No.
Okay.
It could be me because I'm on my mobile phone and then I was smoking a cigarette.
That's what it is. Yeah. Yeah.
Listen, listen. Wait.
You
listen,
can't
listen.
Do a thing. Thing, it seems.
It was that the noise?
Yeah.
No, because I was just thinking about the
We're not talking about the noise, Robert. It's Yeah, just mute, Robert, when, you know, whatever you're doing when you're not speaking. But we're not talking about the noise. There was noise a little while ago. I wondered who it was. Maybe it was you. You muted. It's Andrew's tongue that we're talking about. Right, Sheila? It's this whispering. It's this what you call sibilant part of his voice.
It was both.
Oh, there was environmental, too?
Yeah, I think part of it was the one who was smoking, and the other one was Andrew's sibilant. Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. So maybe we've solved it. You can talk, Andrew. It's not that bad. We've had worse on our other forums. Okay.
I just wanted to say that evokes an interesting image to me because, as Andrew was saying, the countervailing spin. You've got a downward spin and an upward spin apparently happening simultaneously and without interfering with each other.
But that's HTML, too. I mean, you know, the way that the computer works and the Internet, it's the same thing. It's a mirror image. It's like you do the thing, and then you do the reverse thing. And that's, I mean, I don't even know that much about it, but I know that that much is involved in it.
Are you talking about writing code, HTML?
Yeah, it's the same thing as the retrieval thing that you're talking about, or the opposite vortex spin. It's exactly the same thing. It's the mirror image.
Well, what? When you write code, you're bringing in a mirror image?
Yes. When you write code, and I don't know that much about it. Like,
don't worry. We don't care. Nobody knows nothing, so you don't have to qualify what you're saying. Anything else?
But I'm just saying that, you know, as you're talking about this thing that McLuhan came up with, this, you know, this understanding of this pattern, I think that this pattern is echoed in every form of, not just in the way that a TV script is written, but in the way that any gestalt is created. And
well, that, okay, Carol. Yeah. McLuhan wrote how Leibniz discovered the binary aspects of language, of speech. So
yeah.
If you mean the binary, that's latent in any language, in speech.
Yes.
But how is code, give me the technical reason why you're saying it reverses. What does it reverse when you're writing code?
When you make a web page happen and it's in the code that it's in, you put a certain series of numbers and letters and figures or whatever, and then the next line is the complete exact opposite of that.
Oh, you take what you wrote and repeat
yes.
it, but do it backwards.
Yes.
Oh, that's great to know that. I didn't know that.
Yes. So,
and then the third line is some new stuff, and then it's repeated
right.
and reversed
right.
in the fourth line.
Right. I mean, if I'm wrong about this, somebody please let me know. But this is my understanding of the way that code works when you are designing anything that goes online.
Do you know that, Michelle? I guess he's gone.
Hold on.
Michelle thing.
I'm here. I was on mute. Sorry. Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, hold it, Robert. Robert, we asked Michelle. Go ahead, Michelle.
Yeah, I write code, but I'm not seeing that exactly. Sorry.
You don't know that process.
I don't know about writing it backwards. one thing I can tell you is
I think it would apply to the color coding. So you have ones and zeros, and you have color coding which you can adjust to change colors and stuff. But you know they can be both directional.
Well, that would be appropriate to Carol. She's a painter. She's into colors, so maybe that's what you picked up, Carol. The color aspect.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I may not be saying it. Completely correctly, but I think that there is this mirror image thing that goes on when you write code for HTML. And it just seems to me that there's a lot of things in life, on a lot of aspects of life that do that to create the whole. The
they flip.
Experience. Yes.
That's the nature of consciousness. No, really, that's a good point, is that, you know, Zen Buddhism, the I Ching, they talk about the chiasmus, the flip. Anything pushed too far or anyways will flip. And Aquinas and Aristotle talk about when something is in a certain form, actually the opposite form is underneath that's going to emerge. So that flipping, that would be within the dyadic, I'd call it, the dialectical. But the interesting about McLuhan is that when you bring in technological environments, it makes it squared, so there's four factors. So the traditional flip becomes complicated by technology. So you get...
Right.
That's the extra part that McLuhan discovered, I think.
Bob, look again at this image of the vortex. As he grabs onto the barrel and he's going down into the vortex, he's spinning faster and faster into a smaller and smaller space. He goes through the vanishing point and comes back, and then gets spin back out again.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's he gets spit back out.
Well, yeah, but then so then he gets the current that takes him back out. But I think the metaphor applies that because this would be the period of going through the vanishing point because it's the transition from.
Visual print to acoustic tactile electricity.
Right.
The telegraph, yeah. With just a side thing, we learned from Ion that Poe was a parallel world traveler, and Ion tells us the techniques of how to get back. And I'm just thinking for the first time he's describing the parallel world technique. It's okay if you leave here and go to another world, but you got to know how to get back. And that could be the occult level embedded in that story.
And something in that process of reversing or mirroring is probably part of the answer.
Yes, and mirroring, at the key word in McLuhan, one of his first essays in the early 40s, is the analogical mirrors. And you have to realize that McLuhan later shows you there's visual mirrors, acoustic mirrors, tactile mirrors, kinetic mirrors. Every sense is its own form of mirroring. We always like to think of just a visual mirror, like in Sir Isaac Newton's optics. So mirroring, reversing, he then would take that and play with the words matching and making. Matching was a visual mirror, making sure everything looked the same. And making was knowing that you flipped yourself when you looked in the mirror. You actually altered your image. And that includes you also maybe seeing another world. You're making a new world. So making and matching are what McLuhan developed to look at the oddness of different kinds of mirroring.
Well, I think that, though, if you just look at anything in life, any aspect...
You're talking about looking. What about if you listen to anything in life?
But I'm using the word looking in terms of with all your senses, not...
Well, use the word observe.
Okay, observe. When you observe what goes on in life... Am I getting an echo?
Yeah, you get an echo if someone's got you on speakerphone. So everybody cut off their speakerphones or whatever. That'll cause an echo.
But I would just say that, you know, everything in life, every aspect, whether it's your thought process, your emotions, your qualities, what you see, all of it contains a mirror aspect to it.
But what do you mean by mirroring? Do you mean it looks the same? That's the duality of two of everything.
Yeah, it looks the same, or it contains its opposite.
Okay, so that would be polarity.
Right. I mean, but mirrors do that also, don't they? They reverse and switch.
Yeah.
They flip it. Right? They flip it.
Well, it's interesting about mirrors. They both look exact. They got the matching down. They look like you, but they include the making by flipping you. They got eye and ear. If you think of ear as making and eye as matching, and that is the dialectic and symbolism McLuhan's always dealing with. He's always discussing the mirroring process you're talking about, and then he had to look at the fact that television, when you look at yourself on the monitor, when you're in a studio and you're being televised in the camera, your image doesn't flip. Why is that? It's a different kind of mirror. It's an electrical tactile mirror and doesn't flip your image like a flat visual non-electrified mirror does. That's an interesting point that he had to consider. why he says you actually went into a new dimension when you went through, when you had a TV camera.
Well, that's interesting. So the lens is collecting data, photons from the environment. The lens is collecting the image, but you're saying it's not flipping it. Somehow it's going directly into electronic impulses and then
yes.
onto the screen without being flipped.
Right.
Okay. Because ordinarily the lens would be focusing its information onto a mirror behind it, and it
yep.
would flip in the, along the way.
It would have to account for the flip as you made it, yes. What do you think of that, Michelle?
That's a good one.
Oh, I'm here. Sorry,
that's a good,
I'm mute again.
Who
yeah,
said
no,
that's a good
good
one?
Scott.
Who, Scott? Oh, Scott said it. Okay. What do you think of that, Michelle?
Yeah, sounds interesting. Yeah, because the TV camera doesn't have it doesn't work like, I guess, like other camera optics.
Well, the lens would. I think the lens would. It's just that the lens
yeah.
doesn't have to do a flip in order to focus on a mirror. The information just gets conducted right into electrical impulses
right.
and broadcast onto the screen.
Yeah.
And so that's the deeper meaning of light on versus light through. Light on is your visual mirror. The light reflects off it and then reflects into your eye and then gets flipped to your eye. All this light on bouncing. But light through means you're carried into another dimension.
Ooh. Ouch. Good one, Bob.
Well, Prem Rawat speaks about this with receiving knowledge with the mirror. So I think it was right what Michelle said earlier, that the mirror is just this, and you said the symbolism as well, it was receiving the knowledge through the media, which is the way that Prem Rawat delivers his knowledge through the keys. So he was mentioning it, I was listening to it only yesterday, and he emphasized the word mirroring, whereby from now on, listen to me and receive knowledge from me, and it will be a relationship that will last for a long, long time. So it's something that writers do, you know, you have to build a relationship.
Robert, you've got to cover a whole bunch of different themes there. In McLuhan's Monday Night Seminars, if someone would read a poem, let's say they went on for 3 minutes, you go, too many words, hold it. See, McLuhan wouldn't let any word go by him. Every word, he wanted to make you conscious of every word. Now, you covered a lot of things. You mentioned symbolism, mirroring, psychological continuity, something sticking with you for wisdom. And you used the word media. You actually had it all garbled up. And I don't mean, I'm not criticizing your moral character, Robert. I'm just talking about your words and what those words said to me. You said that it depends on the media. Well, no, the media depends on how the mirror happens.
I don't know. I think when you bring the technology into the concept of mirroring with relation to Edgar Allan Poe and everybody, it is, I suppose, down to an expert of a camera and knowing the lens. But, you know, it wouldn't be kind of backwards. It would be upside down or something like that. But,
that's
know,
what we mean. Yeah, upside down. That's what I'm thinking of reversing.
I think the link with the mirroring has to be dismissed as through the lens. It's more through the eye of the receiver and the communicator.
Okay, so you're saying television does not flip your image because depending on who's looking at the TV.
Well, it's the passive audience, isn't it? You know, and to receive the knowledge in this case from the. You know, like the Krishnamurti kind of vibe. It's learning to receive and just enjoy the kind of knowledge and not participate. You know, it's not asking for participation.
All right, that's consumerism, which comes in with the mechanical bias. You know, Robert, that McLuhan critiqued the consumerist attitude towards mysticism and knowing versus the participatory thing. Now, you're pointing out the distinction. Are you saying that the consumer passive non-participation is more viable?
I think it's from when you're saying with the thing with the war and stuff like that, if we're going by this original essay that you're talking about, no, I didn't make that link, but you know more about it than what I do, but I was just thinking maybe there's some kind of, even with the bride thing, you know, when she went to Germany to write the Frankenstein book, there's this kind of missing of technology as well. You know, so you go and kind of, you go somewhere where it's peaceful and you kind of get used to the technology, you get used to the electricity, and then it inspires you, you know. So it's that coming away from the technology, which is very productive as creative.
You're saying that's what Mary Shelley did? She withdrew into a pastoral environment?
Well, she wrote the book at Lord Byron's castle, so she was in the kind of German throes of Lord Byron and his kind of hedonistic ways. So, but she must have had a lot of peace to write that book.
Okay, let me just throw this in, since we're doing McLuhan, Robert. Let me throw this in. Robert, hold it. In this essay I'm reading, The Southern Quality, it's all about the Byronic influence. Byron was the throwback to the Southern agrarian tradition in Europe. So it's interesting that she wrote that under the influence of Byron's milieu. He is a major representative of the tradition that Poe carries on. So that's a subplot to what you're just saying there.
There's a tetrad, though, Bob, like back in your screenwriting, tetrads for screenwriting there, that like the isolation is amplified, the inclusion is obsolesced, what is retrieved is alienation, and there's a flip into the superstardom of the author. So with, you know, there is...
Yeah, you're saying that this the person, a private person goes and withdraws in their own little womb, writes a book, and then inflicts her private product on the masses through the printing press. That's what you're saying?
No, I'm just saying we're continuing with the theme of tetrads for screenwriters here, and here we're at some... Is it Robert's just outlining a strategy, a private artistic strategy, how it mimes the operations of the tetrad as well? So.
Right. So can you do it again? You're saying that you enhance what in this process? Isolation?
Well, Robert was saying that somebody pulled away, so they enhance their isolation. What does that obsolesce? It obsolesces their inclusion, their involvement, their participation in the world. What does it retrieve? A sense of alienation or first-timeness, you know, that the childlike mind, and flips into, well, the superstardom.
A lack of isolation.
Yeah.
No. It's what the knowledge is actually about is understanding the mirroring concept of listening to yourself. So, you know,
yeah,
it's good
I
practice for if you're going for the radio. Or in Mary Shelley's case, it would have been the theatre, because she was writing Frankenstein for a play. She wasn't writing it for the film through the lens.
Robert, it's a very interesting phrase about listening to yourself. What do you think McLuhan meant when he said, print, crack the voices of silence? That's something I've thought about for a long time. What are the voices of silence? What one does in a meditative state by themselves listening to their voice? See, there, and
like,
this is what...
It's knowledge. It's what Prem Rawat calls knowledge.
Well, if Mark Stahl was here, you wouldn't get very far with that. That would be labeled Gnostic Manichaeism. What is knowledge? You know, does an Aboriginal person in New Zealand have knowledge? Not in the literary sense, not in the alphabetic or manuscript sense,
but in another sense, they do.
And what is that sense? See, there's the word sense. What sense? Tactile?
If they're living in the wilderness...
Language is limited, Bob. You know, it doesn't describe everything.
Yeah, we know that, but we can still use it in careful new ways. What'd you say, Scott?
If they're living in the outbacks of Australia, far from... the world of civilized man, they certainly have knowing. They wouldn't survive a day without it.
But wouldn't you say that the knowing, it would be better to describe its environmental, it's a knowing within their environment as opposed to the literary knowing that Robert's talking about?
Oh yeah, it's intuitive. It's more right brain based.
That's really what it is. It's a more developed right brain.
How about it's not even brain? It's not even in the skull. It's more in the gut, or it might even be astral, other energies, non-visible energies.
Yeah, but you know, according to what we're told, and maybe it's wrong, that would take place in the right side of the brain as opposed to the left, which is the logic side, right?
Right.
So they would be to me, the way that I think about it is they're highly intelligent in right brain functioning. And, you know, we in the West are highly intelligent in West brain. The problem with all of it, our left brain, is that we're not more balanced. Because it's the intelligence.
But you know, McLuhan's point, Carol, was that we were balanced by television. Television balanced all the world's cultures as an invisible fulcrum.
I didn't know about that. But
no, you didn't know about that. That's McLuhan recently, we found this essay.
Well, Bob, does it then follow television as the corpus callosum?
Yeah. It's the extension. Well, I would say the digital is the extension of the in-between spaces within the central nervous system. So the digital is the corpus.
Say that again, Bob. Say that again.
Television is an extension of the central nervous system in general. The aspects, different parts of our central nervous system, our brain functions and all that, is extended by the digital. It TV is more general and tactile. The digital takes particular functions, including the proprioceptive, from the central nervous system and specializes and fragments that into the web.
But does not affect the autonomic nervous system. You just said the central nervous system.
Yeah, the autonomic is maybe what. That's a good point. We're doing a lot with the autonomic with ion. I see ion as an extension of the autonomic system, but the autonomic system could be included in the central nervous system in general, and the computer grabs the autonomic things and makes it an environment around us. Right now, 24/7, there's information being exchanged that we're not aware of and we don't have to be aware of, just like you don't have to be aware of your blood and your instinctive autonomic systems in your body.
Under what conditions does the autonomic system be differentiated from the central nervous system? When was the date or dates or times when it was seen as different?
I saw it on Wiki a few weeks ago where there's three systems. The parasympathetic and the, what's the other one, Carolyn? Sympathetic, and there's three of them. And the motor, and they were probably identified within the last 100 years. Yeah, Carolyn nods at least with like 50 or 80 years ago, Andrew.
So do we have different media biases for how we split up the nervous system?
Yes, and we call it mirroring and making. But yes, we're talking about the interior landscape and different cultures. Forms of knowing in the interior landscapes of their culture. That's the key issue here.
So where do we go for this? This is Paramedia now, yeah?
Yeah.
What kind of books is maybe some with some Marshall McLuhan sites in it? What's a book, a Paramedia book that
Finnegan's Wake.
Go to?
Finnegan's Wake is the ultimate Paramedia book.
He's coming from all directions.
and he's describing how radio and TV and satellites come from all directions.
Plus, it's a movie, a satellite environment, a television environment for your eye, for your visual sense.
Yeah, the great line.
The visual sense is isolated from the other senses when you're reading. And so it's hard for it to encompass the other senses. But Joyce does it through Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, you look at the middle of page 52. I've quoted this a million times. It's my favorite part of the book, but it gives the key. He says, television kills telephony or telephony in Brothers Broil. That's like Cain and Abel. The eyes demand their turn. Let them be seen. So Joyce retrieved the function of the book. So it could be looking at the battle between television and telephone. That's what McLuhan said Joyce accomplished. He found a way to revitalize the book, but it's an unreadable book in literary terms.
he never cites McLuhan, so it's not the book that I was really asking for.
No, no, no. He does cite McLuhan, Robert. Page 254. This book comes out in 1939, and he describes McLuhan to the T, including the word extensions.
Me
all the stuff
you.
That McLuhan was known for is there on page 254. He's called Mearsham McLuhan, and even McLuhan recognized it because
in his
own copies of Finnegan's Wake, which I have Xeroxes of, he says me, and he puts underneath Moonchild.
Moonchild.
That's right.
Of course.
Okay, but you're saying there's some book that cites McLuhan, so it's after McLuhan.
Yeah, I'm talking about a book with the label Paramedia on the front of it because I did kind of – I would say that you at the beginning you did distinguish us as paramedia, but you know, and we know Ion's very much para, the part, and I'm waiting for this next level of the bodies thing as well. I'm looking forward to that, but
yeah, no, I don't know. Do you know a book with the title Paramedia in it, Andrew?
Oh, I thought we were speaking it into existence right now, and somebody's going to do an archaeology of this recording.
Yeah, Robert is from the future, placed in our past. Yeah, Robert, again, you're seeing something that only you see, but it's real.
Well, no, I'm just – I think I'm speaking for anybody who is an academic is like, how do you – if you were going to write about – or you even going to talk about Marshall McLuhan at one of these talks around Europe and in Hawaii and everywhere else, it's like, how do you draw upon James Joyce's in your academic – our speech about whatever essay we're talking about on Marshall McLuhan, and then really tap into the James Joyce thing, because there's not many books that you're the only person that I know that brings it on.
And
it has started changing around the world.
Don Thiel's Trinity of Words, Beyond the Words, Technopoetics, and James Joyce and the Virtual Marshall McLuhan. And if you keep them in mind that he's writing a fourth book that is, well, before he died, The Prehistory of Digiculture, that's the book that you want to interface with.
Yeah, that's Don Thiel, T-H-E-A-L-L, McLuhan's first PhD student, probably wrote the best books on McLuhan, and a member of our Paramedia School. Don Thiel was a tremendous member, founding member, and he died in 2008. But this thing about what you're saying about writing a book, Robert, Joyce begins Finnegan's Wake imagining himself in a pub with everybody talking away, and he tries to write down what he's hearing. So he's going to write down all the voices that he hears. So he's taking this living environment, the pub, translating the acoustic environment into visual space. And doing it literally. That's why Finney's Wake is all about Here Comes Everybody. Now, McLuhan recognized that the electric world and the global theater was externalizing the pub. So it was everywhere. And this, right now, what we're doing is the example of the pub. So we are in the situation, the paramedium situation. Now, what medium is the best one to translate what we're doing? A recording of this? Somebody writing minutes? Someone doing a play, someone making a movie of it, you know, that's the... So Joyce looked at his Finnegan's Wake as taking that pub experience and translating it into different media. And that's the hidden plot of Finnegan's Wake, the drama of translating the basic act of human beings speaking together in a group.
Some reason when you said that there, I thought of Rudolf Steiner, because, Rudolf Steiner, when a lot of his books were kind of transcribed from talks which he did, which he had people doing it, and that's the kind of the channeling of the knowledge, of the kind of layers of stuff.
Well, McLuhan did the same thing. He dictated a lot of his articles and books to his secretary.
But not to an actual audience of people.
Well, he spoke in front of audiences a lot, and he did it in his seminars. I don't know of anybody who wrote down every word he said as he was saying it. Because he would not encourage, you could say, that when he left the group that he was addressing, goes back to his office, then replays what he said to the group to his secretary, who writes it down and translates it into a letter or to an article into visual space. McLuhan knew that he was fragmenting the initial experience when he was speaking in the group, and he would study the effects of that, but he would do that, put it in visual form, as a mirror to what one thought they were knowing when they were hearing the public speaking live. It's the contrast and comparing of different social communication levels.
Is that on magnetic tape, is it, or is that on a record?
What he dictated?
Yeah.
Well, there's lots of recordings of McLuhan. We have a lot in the classroom, but it would be typed by a secretary.
From magnetic recording?
No. You see, he would speak, she'd type it, and then it would be published as a visual artifact. But
yeah,
there are recordings of McLuhan.
Almost a moment of silence for the genius of Mark Stewart in terms of translating McLuhan into visual terms.
That's right. Mark Stewart was so important, and Carol and I were fortunate to meet her in 78, and she fell off a ladder in May 1978 at her cottage and broke her hip. And Carol, being a doctor, we were asked to look at her, and then we became friends and were taken into confidant. But I witnessed many times when Marshall would phone her at home, pleading for her to get back to the office because chaos was happening. And the stress of not having Margaret there organize everything constantly and really be
myself into visual space.
Yeah, yeah. And because Margaret never got back, it put McLuhan under a lot of pressure, and you could say that that's why he had a heart attack.
No, he had a stroke.
Or a stroke. Says Carolyn. But the pressure of that, and the secretary that substituted was terrible, Eleanor Austin. And there's lots of stories about what that was all about. She was sent over by Father Kelly, and it was rumored or legendary there was a battle between Father Kelly, who ran St. Michael's, and McLuhan. They didn't like each other, so who knows what was up. But on a personal note, when I was doing the archives in November, December 81, with Corinne McLuhan and Mady Molinaro, they were looking for a certain document, and they speculated that Eleanor Austin had it. And so I called up Eleanor Austin to see if she had it, and she didn't, but I got some basic information that might have helped us. And when I told Corinne and Mady, they were outraged that I spoke to Eleanor. They didn't want to know the information from that source. But that was the antagonism between the Eleanor Austin secretary work and Mark Stewart. Eleanor Austin left the thing in a mess. Food was thrown into the filing cabinets. It was crazy. Whereas Mark Stewart was fastidious and very particular from 63 to 1978. And when she found out these basic five books, which had the diaries or the daily reporting of everybody who called McLuhan or visited, people all over the world, famous and not so famous, everything was logged in there. They went missing, and that almost killed Margaret.
Yeah, that's a shame.
But they were found, apparently.
The management, the fact that it was in place, though, I think it's very organized, the whole thing, and it's a shame the stuff went missing, you know, but...
No, Robert, it was found again.
Oh, it was. That's good.
I don't see any publication of it, but I understand that they were found eventually, years later.
No, that's good. It just goes to show how well organized things are. That's how you get a good book. That's how you get a good person who everyone want to come and see. It's organization.
Yeah, that's the art of using your left hemisphere in the right hemisphere or corpus callosum environment, which is in between, more accurate than saying right hemisphere, how you retrieve the visual coordinates of your literary tradition and use them, and the discipline that comes from that, in a chaotic world. That's what Finnegan's Wake is trying to help you get. Joyce throws you into the maelstrom of Finnegan's Wake. I'm sure he's aware of Poe, and you learn to navigate in there.
There's definitely a poetic link between all of it, because there's Poe, there's Shelley, there's Marshall, there's the you know, the writing format, and you know, you bring it into the lens of the video, which is today, you know, which is now. It's the YouTube generation. It's the you know, it's the since the 70s of TV and passive viewing, and
here's a fact for Bob.
Who's got a barbecue going? Mute.
excuse me for interrupting, but I just wanted to. The now I just became self-conscious for interrupting. I forgot what I was saying. It'll come back to me, and I'll interrupt again later.
Okay, now, Art McKay, Sheila, whoever else is here, bring up other things that you're interested in, or raise questions, or say some stuff. We want everybody to have a chance to talk.
Oh, I know. Okay, sorry. Another factor I wanted to bring in about Finnegan's Wake is that I've often heard, you know, Ion talks about the importance of the words that we choose to speak to speak out loud, and I've often heard that Finnegan's Wake is meant to be read aloud. That brings a whole other dimension into the book world. I mean, that's a translation of visual space into the speech.
Yeah, the Ion is a fanatic media ecologist for speech, and I've brought him into an awareness of the later technologies, and that's led to all kinds of interesting discoveries, especially in our series on the Book of Revelations and how the printing press is the major thing that John of Patmos was frightened by, what that would do. And that resonates when I told this to Mary McLuhan, Marshall's one of his daughters. She said, you know, that's what Marsh used to always say. He got it all from the Bible. And, well, there's this whole media level in the Bible that he was intuiting that is being completed in our access to Ion, who apparently is the guy who wrote the Bible.
John of Patmos would not have known about the printing press, so why would he be concerned about it?
Ah, what makes you think that he'd be incapable of knowing about it?
Well, when did he live?
He lives forever.
Oh.
Okay. There's no time, Scott. Remember that stuff.
Oh, that's right. We're back. We're marching backwards into the. We're marching.
We're not. We're already there.
Just thought of is the pixelated link of the cartoons. You know, another. I don't know what the cartoon link is with Marshall McLuhan, but there's a link there with the original Frankenstein was made into comics and stuff like that for the posters. And,
okay, now Robert, what are you saying? There's a link about what? Marshall was a professor of literature. He knew the whole history of poetry. Of course, he knew about it. But what do you mean by link?
Well, it's words and pictures, isn't it? You know. But
what are words and pictures?
What people don't generally talk about, but
they talk about words and pictures all the time. I'm going to be hard on you, Robert. So you focus.
No, it's the addressing all audiences. So when you're writing, even though Mary Shelley's writing a horror thing, she's writing it to kids, and I presume that Marshall McLuhan, when he's writing his book as well, he's writing it for all ages of people.
No, he did not consider his writings literature, and he was not writing to preserve for all time. He considered that enterprise of writing obsolete. He was only providing first aid kits. He said that.
Yeah, but that's where the cartoon extension comes into play. Is like it's the.
Yes, he did say that he wrote cartoons. That comes out in the Carol Appel quote. That's a good point, Robert. You evoked the point that Carol in this interview in 1973. He says Carol Appel approached McLuhan and says, "You know, I regard your books as cartoons. You write cartoons," and McLuhan loved that because he knew he was writing cartoons.
Well, Mary Shelley's The Frankenstein was all promoted through theatrical thing with the cartoon images that were already shaped and designed by herself, but then they were re-edited by artists for, you know.
Okay, on my tiny note chart, I've got in the Android level, I've got Croker and Dr. Beter. Dr. Beter is notorious for talking about the organic robotoids. So that's human bodies being cloned or mutated into mini Frankensteins. Arthur Croker, building on the McLuhan tradition, talks about the horrible environment. And what you just said makes that distinction. Could you just say a few words what you just said?
I think I've heard it on one of the documentaries as well. It was taking the fear and making it less fearful, you know, so that's what cartoons do as well.
Oh, yeah, cartoons. So here it is. You have the cartoon Frankenstein, whatever, promoting the content idea of this cyborg. But McLuhan was pointing out, or maybe James Joyce and William Burroughs were pointing out that the cartoon as an environment killed the literary enterprise. So the cartoon environment was the monster, not the particular Frankenstein figure in the content of the cartoon. That's the kind of ways McLuhan would interpret things, what I just said.
What are you referring to, the cartoon environment?
Yeah, the medium of the cartoon.
Well, that doesn't.
Could that barely
takes up space in the total environment of everything else that's going on.
Oh, that's all kids learn by Saturday morning cartoons. Of course, it's 24/7. They drink everything as cartoons, and that's what the Mechanical Bride was about comics. McLuhan actually said Mechanical Bride was a play, a drama between ads and cartoon characters. He considered the drama in Mechanical Bride not the critical literary content, but the drama between the cartoon, Blondie comics versus the ads. Now, he says this to his mother. He says it's a new kind of science fiction novel. The cartoon and the ads were in a battle. It was an update of Television Kills Telephony.
What's the tension there? What's the battle between
the
dominant environment, really?
Okay, three people. Robert, finish your point, then be quiet. What is it?
It was just the Mary Shelley link with the Penny Dreadfuls that were coming out, which were very popular in London, and a lot of them, I think women were involved in it as well, because there was the...
You're saying that Mary Shelley's book circulated in the Penny Circular level?
No, what I'm saying is there was a lot of women in London involved in that scene.
In what scene?
Women, the horror comics.
Hey, what were they doing? Making them?
Well, the Penny Dreadfuls, they're called, isn't it? But
okay. You mean they were selling them? What does it mean to be involved in a scene?
You see, a lot of with this academic stuff with the print and press, it never gets actually mentioned a lot. Although it
does now, Robert. Nothing but cultural studies in universities and the humanities thing. That's all they do is analyze old media.
I know, because one of my lecturers was a female, and she researched the book. I can't think of her name now, but she's got a big book on printing press, and it's about women. And, she's the one who told me about the Penny Dreadfuls anyway.
Okay, but you're not telling us. Are you saying women made the Penny Dreadfuls? They were cartoonists, or they sold it? Like, how were they involved?
Well, if you think about the time of what was actually going on as well with...
Okay, forget it, Robert, forget it. Hey, Scott, take a break, Robert. I don't mean to mean, but you're dominating and you're not making your point. You got to be brief. So, Scott, what were you going to say?
I couldn't get quite visualize what you meant by the warfare between the cartoon and the advertising. What's the tension or the battle going on or the struggle there?
Okay, I immediately think of McLuhan... commenting on Watergate, he said it was a battle between newspaper and television for the advertising dollar. In other words, nothing to do with Nixon or the plumbers or any of the scandalous anthropomorphic human beings involved. It was a battle between forms. The newspaper was being sidelined, like TV is today versus the Internet. The newspaper is being sidelined, so he writes in Carpenter's book, They Became What They Beheld, in the late 60s, that the newspaper was forced to take on a counterculture or underground role. So the New York Times started finding this Watergate dirt out. And they're doing that so people read their newspaper and they get the advertising dollar. And they're up against Dan Rather and CBS, the new dominant medium for news sobriety, and they were not covering the Watergate in the detail and exposure. They were like protecting the White House, that's the television, versus the newspaper radicals at the New York Times. So the larger, in the language of forms, Watergate was a battle between the newspaper and the television. Now take that back, put it back 30 years back into the 40s, and you see that you have a battle between advertising and cartoon for the mind of kids, and it's a symbiotic ecology. Remember, he says you can't have good news without bad news.
Yeah.
They used it's an ecology. The
yeah,
good news
well,
is the ads, and the bad news is all the terrible wars and stuff. So that dialectic is always happening. It's a symbiosis, and in this case, it was cartoon versus ads. So that's the beginning way to look at it.
Systole, diastole.
Is there another aspect to the cartoons and ads that relates to theaters, when the cartoons were taken out of theaters and then it was all trailers for upcoming movies?
Well, McLuhan, the simple key, and this is why McLuhan's not hard to understand, his formula was, okay, the cartoons aren't in the movies anymore, so I look around to see what technology has caused that change. And what was it? Cable TV? The computer, you just look around and see what's the latest technology. It's really formulaic of how you use McLuhan. And you just say, well, what's the latest technology? Well, that caused the removal of cartoons from the theater and put in the excessive trailers that one has to watch. See, that's all you do when you're doing McLuhan. The reason is in the key of social change is in the technology that's arrived on the scene. So television made a battle between the old environments, cartoons and ads. The hidden ground was television.
Bob, to come back around to the article that you started with, the Southern Quality, is it possible to say then, like McLuhan saying that personal responsibility and the absence of a private life are necessary to have this kind of anticipatory awareness of forms or the life of forms?
No, that's a really good point. Like there's this essay called The Southern Quality and the other one, Edgar Poe's Tradition, are fantastic for seeing the map of what McLuhan would say later. He says Southern life, the aristocratic life, with servants in that means the aristocrat has no privacy. Not like the people in the cities got the little rooms and apartments, they got privacy. And so McLuhan is talking about the Orwellian world that's coming. He's saying you're going into a world where there's no privacy, total surveillance. You better start understanding how the Southerners dealt with that. They led to a formal code between the aristocrat and his servants. They never related personally, even though the servant saw everything about the aristocrat and vice versa. That's a really good example, Andrew.
Wow. I didn't realize that's what that was all about.
Yeah, it's really a key point that Andrew is reminding me of in that essay. And he italicizes it, doesn't he, Andrew?
Yeah, so perhaps even more decisive at any time or place in the creation of the aristocrat is absence of private life.
And so here we are, since the 50s, the abundant American dream society for the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, was everybody, McLuhan said, wanted to be an aristocrat, but they did not, literate Westerners could not handle the fact of no privacy in the aristocratic situation. So everybody became a king with their own car and television and all the abundance and golf courses and all that stuff, and yet secretly the global surveillance was coming in, but that's natural in acoustic space. There's no privacy. So you see how McLuhan aestheticized the very effects that Orwell just panicked about.
Is there any parallels that could have been made from the sorry to butt in, Bob. Is there any parallels that can be made to explain the division between Canadian and American interpretations of the whole thing?
Yeah, McLuhan did a lot on that. And what would you say, Andrew or Michelle, if Michelle's still here about that?
I'll leave it to Michelle. I'm just going to nip off for a second.
Okay, what was the question?
What is the cultural differences between Canadians and Americans, Robert asked.
No, I mean, you can look at it even on the scale of the demographics and the representation of TV viewing and how the American, because you said the American dream and how that stardom, and it's possibly, it may be.
McLuhan said the American dream became a world environment.
Yeah.
You've already explained it. You know, that's what I'm
okay,
saying.
Robert, listen to Michelle. Go ahead, Michelle.
Well, I mean, there's a million things you could say. One thing that he liked to say is, and this is he often remarked that it was nice to be in Canada because you were sort of, it was like an observation post. You were kind of off in an eddy. And I always remember, you might have seen, when he started explorations back in the 50s, it actually, that became quite a sensation. It didn't run for very long, but it had a sort of a worldwide impact in scholarly circles. And he talks about it in one of the interviews and says that since everything in the world is second rate, we figured we could do something first rate right here.
That's right. So that's in a Gerald Stern interview, Hot and Cool.
Yeah, right, right. And
which you published in your book.
That's right. Yeah. But the idea of a sort of a stealth environment, and you know the fact that we have so many Canadians in Hollywood, for example. One of the things I like to think about Canada is that it's still possible to incubate there. It's still possible to, you know, Jim Carrey's Canadian. I mean, name anybody. You know, all these people, they had time to develop.
That's one thing I think about Canada, and I think it applies to McLuhan, that there he is up there at St. Michael's in Toronto, and his subject is really things like America, right? He's looking at that, but he has time to do it. So that's one thing I would mention.
Yeah, this is a key point, Robert, the dialectic between Canada and McLuhan, and States, and McLuhan, but he stood in the interval. He was the corpus callosum translating America back to the Canadians and translating Canadians back to Americans. And a couple of main points he made is he said, first of all, Canada was a borderline case. It was the only country in the world that was so close to the United States, to the elephant, that it got the virus first, and it had to deal with it. So it saw the technological abundance first, and that's probably why Canadian literature by America Atwood and the rest of them later is interesting to the Swedes and university departments all over the world, because they are all Canadians. They're all up against this world environment. But Canada was there earliest and produced the first writers about it. And that explains
That's amazing.
Popularity of Canadian literature around the world. But the borderline case is that not only was Canada up against America, it was up against French culture in Quebec, up against Aboriginal culture with the Eskimos and the Indians, and it was up against Russia. And so it actually was the most central position in the switchboard of the global theater. It was encountering all kinds of cultures in its own structure, its environment. So it was a borderline case. He also said because it was a borderline case, it did not have a national identity. It did not have a civil war that creates a national identity. And if you don't have a national identity, you're more able to handle the 21st century, which is this blurred world where nationalism is weak and high profile is a problem. That's the very problem of America. High profile national identity can't handle the blur of the global theater. Well, we should all become Canadians. That would be the update to Southern tradition. He dropped being a Southerner and said, everybody should become a Canadian.
No, well, they would definitely be consuming the American content. But what I was going to ask you is, because I studied Jack Cousteau for my final dissertation. Well, it wasn't even a dissertation, was it? But, like, I did a Jack Cousteau thing, and it's just that, would you say that the 50th state would be a fair kind of middle ground now that the technology is kind of leveled out and everybody has it? And obviously that division between Canada and America is getting closer, a more united kind of thing. And Hawaii is that kind of middle ground where you're holding the McLuhan. It's like the new American dream as well now, isn't it, Hawaii? So perhaps Hawaii is the American dream, the Canadian dream.
Okay, two points there, Robert. I mean, Karen and I talk about we're living in the scenario used in a lot of advertising in the last 50 years. The tropical beach, the paradisical environment, it's not as much now, but it was the main ground in advertising. And so we're living where all people's desires are heading towards or being prompted to be into. And so it's interesting, you're right, we're in the heart of the Android meme here. On the other side, behind the stage, our environment is what everybody's being teased by. Okay, that's one aspect. The blurring between Canada, United States, and Mexico is a factor. But the thing is, you're looking at the world as a movie, and you're looking at the characters, Canada, United States, and Europe and Russia. These are characters on the cinematic view of the world, but that's the eye view. We are in a non-visible world right now, the tactile membrane. So the blurring happens everywhere, no matter what stage of cultural industry they have. The blurring, the tactile thing threatens every culture in the world. The tactile effect of the digital or just TV. Anything you would say to that, Andrew?
No, but I would like to propose, as we've got essentially 10 more minutes to go, that we look to take in inventory of questions and we resume next week.
Let me see. We have a meeting, Andrew, at 10 o'clock, which is Eastern Time. No, that's 11 o'clock. I think we got another 30 minutes, Andrew. If anybody wants to stay on, I'll stay on. Or are you thinking in practical listening time terms, Andrew?
Yeah, practical listening time terms, also for people's enjoyment, who are not party to these the immediacy of this conversation. I'm willing to take it any way people want. So if people want to go on, they can go on.
Yeah, we can go on and we can stop the recording. Well, you can always chop it off. We could even offer long version and short versions.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, I'm just going to go look at the recording and see what the actual timing, since I started, it is, it's only an hour and 30 minutes, only 90 minutes. But anyways, let's do an end request. Let's do a, what's been left out?
Yeah, what we can, if we could have a quick round in terms of like questions, issues, themes, peoples that people want to see on the seminar series. There's definitely a, an ethos of trying to serve, trying to provide nutriment and to be of value, and tapping Bob's vast resources of connections and networks. And so if people want to take this anywhere they want, then give us a list and we'll go.
Yeah, suggest guests, guests of honor.
Or people can email them at you know, from the McLuhan Conference website, and I guess with Bob we'll set about trying to actually institute it.
Right. While you're thinking about that, Frankenstein was published anonymously in London in 1818, and The Pit and the Pendulum was a short story published in 1842. Let's just see what it says. The story is about the torments endured by a prisoner of the Spanish Inquisition. Though Poe skews historical facts, the narrator, now there he is, being, you know, he's not being too literary, too visual, too definite. The narrator of the story describes his experience being tortured. The story is especially effective at inspiring fear in the reader because of its heavy focus on the senses, such as sound, emphasizing its reality. That's acoustic space! Unlike many of Poe's stories, which are aided by the supernatural, the traditional elements established in popular horror tales as the at the time are followed, but critical reception has been mixed. So he was talking about, McLuhan was saying, he was talking about acoustic space that was being brought in by the telegraph and would frighten the hell out of the visual bias people. And they would interpret it as torture.
You know, if you're starting to get topics, it's Sheila here. Something that I would be, being an environmentalist and everything, I'd like to tease out some of the nature/environment connections here. And a couple of things that struck me from tonight's discussion was, I love that part about electricity is a biological event, but I have missed past discussions of that, so I'd like to visit that. And then you were talking about the House of the Seven Gables, and the writer was saying that the telegraph, was it, creates a global membrane?
Yes.
So I like that concept. I'd like to explore more the concept of the global membrane. And then it's making me think about where we're going now with the, you know, social networking and all the stuff that has just happened in the that is happening in the Middle East. And, you know, what the global membrane has to do, how that fits into the global membrane and so on. It would be fun to go off kind of in that direction.
Yeah, well, that's, we're always, what you're describing, Sheila, is what McLuhan was always talking about, the crisis of the global membrane, what it did to different cultures, and what it, and he foresaw that the digital media would retrieve visual space and privacy in the
yes.
virtual sense. So he knew that all that he was known to talk about was going to be contradicted by what was coming in the digital, but he didn't live into that.
Well, yeah, but the other thing is that, you know, what is happening in the Middle East, as I see it, is the beginning of, you know, a whole domino thing.
Yeah, it's there, Europe 1989.
That would
right?
be a good session, I think, would be to do a whole session in and around that Middle East.
Yes, yes, that's what I'm suggesting. I'm not suggesting we get into this evening. I'm suggesting that it could be an interesting jumping-off point for another evening.
Well, Sheila, when we're talking about, here's what McLuhan did. He would write about the future by using the past. When we talk about the effect of the telegraph and what it did to Poe and literature, we apply that to the present. What's happening to Egyptian culture by the new media, the Twittering, which caused the revolution? You know, so it's always the same formula. What is, and we can jump like Poe from time era to era because we all had the same problem beginning with speech. I mean, back then there were, you know, cavemen grunting, we're speaking too much. We can't control us, wrecking our shamanistic values. We're losing our touch with our subconscious. We can't trance anymore.
Yes, but the tweeting and the Facebooking and all that kind of stuff, that was the end product of what the influence produced. But, you know, what were the things that happened leading up to that?
Sheila, what was leading up to it was all the cultures themselves. You have the Muslim religion or Islamic religion. You have the Muslim Brotherhood. You have the Saudi princes. You have the oil industry. You have Egypt's role as a mediator with Israel. Those were what was happening, right?
Yeah, but the rest of the world's influence was happening too, you know.
Okay, rest of the world would be rest of the four worlds. The first world is advanced in capitalism. The second world is Russian bureaucracy. These are McLuhan's terms. Third world is the underdeveloped world. And the fourth world is the electric world that went around them. That, you should say plural. What was the rest of the world doing to Cairo?
Yeah. Exactly. So I think that would be interesting to explore. To go, you know, to look at that area over the world, you know.
We will do that, and I consider it was done tonight, even though it never got mentioned, because it is the present that is pressing on every one of us, anyways, due to the global membrane.
So there was a ratio of tensions among those.
What'd you say, Scott? Yeah, ratio, the symmetry
ratio,
of tension.
There was a ratio of tensions among the four worlds that you just delineated.
That's right.
Where are we now in relation to those four worlds? Have they imploded?
Oh, yeah, they've been scrapped. That was symbolized by the collapse of Wall Street, you know, 2 years ago. Hey, Sheila, whatever I just said was not meant to be taken personally. I'm just reacting to your words the way McLuhan would. You said those words,
I
say these words. You know what I mean?
I get it totally.
Okay, that's what we're talking impersonally here, hopefully.
Yeah.
We're using words to make discoveries.
Yeah.
You know, the information is speeded up. You know, it's a good point because, like, a lot of the, like you say, the Islamic people in these areas, there's only a limited number of people who have the internet, and they're on forums, they're on YouTube, and, you know, they're gathering information with the kind of understanding of their...
You said there are a limited number of people gathering information?
And information, you know, it was at a time when... 20 or 30 years ago, or whenever we talk about when this change with TV happened, but now...
No, with the digital. You're talking about the old world of TV. That was changed by the digital.
Vision is probably something that is more... that you could look at more in these countries. Yeah, because they're consuming it a lot more. Mobile phones is another one as well, like in India and stuff like that. You know, it's... it's all new stuff, isn't it? Whereas Twitter is kind of like, it's part of it, but it's something that's not really, I suppose you can do because it's the transference of information from Israel immediately to the Western world. So it's a very good point.
Okay, Art McKay, what do you have to say if you're still here? I don't think he's here. Okay, Sheila, I'm looking up the House of Seven Gables, 1851, which poet and critic James Russell Lowell said was better than the Scarlet Letter and called it the most valuable contribution to New England history that has been made. So, you know, House of Seven Gables, it's not Melville, it's Nathaniel Hawthorne. Sorry,
Nathaniel Hawthorne, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm finding the literary discussion absolutely scintillating. You know, I majored in English literature, and I've hardly touched it since I finished university. And so many of the people that I studied have been mentioned tonight, and it's just it's thrilling. It's the
first literary discussion
I've had in a long time.
Right. That's why get interior landscape. McLuhan's literary criticism is so astounding because he covers the whole range of Western canon, you know, 2,000 years, and he makes these large patterns that are really useful. Like he's writing about the value of the South in response to the effect of the atomic bomb. He's always dealing with the present, but he gives you a way to look at the battle between the dialecticians and grammarians and rhetoricians. And I find it's like Michelle said, what he says about Hawthorne or about different authors is more interesting than what the author did with their own books. So you want a revitalized sense of English literature history, that McLuhan's interior landscape is where it's at.
Good stuff.
Yeah. And he's a philosopher in it. He's applying the identity of the creative process to this. He's implying incredible insights that aren't even recognized because they're scattered throughout all the essays. Here and there, the basic points. Page 32 is really important in the book. I mean, I'll just listen to this. Talk about taking today in the 50s, going back to Greece, he says there's always, he's describing how James Joyce wrote Ulysses, and there's always the liturgical level as well. Nothing Joyce ever wrote lacks that dimension. One significance of Stephen's surname, Dedalus. So Stephen is the young guy up against Leopold Bloom, and he has the last name Dedalus, which is the French form of Daedalus, is that Daedalus is the inventor of the labyrinth. And Daedalus was accredited with having been the first being to reduce the ancient initiation rituals to the form of art. That is to say, Daedalus was the first to grasp the relation between the pagan rebirth rituals and the labyrinthine retracings of the artistic process. See, McLuhan is on to the retracings of the artistic process. Then McLuhan writes, the pagan rituals were imitations of nature because the soul imprisoned in existence could only be released by retracing the stages of its fall and descent through the various degrees of material being. There's your Edgar Cayce theosophy right there. Necessarily, McLuhan says, therefore, all artistic imitation first arose from the pagan liturgies or mysteries. If Daedalus was the first to note this relation, and that would be, 10,000 years ago, James Joyce was the first to see in these ancient rituals of descent and return. Think of the descent into the maelstrom, Poe's maelstrom, descent and return. He saw in those rituals the perfect externalization in drama and gesture of the stages of human apprehension or the creative process. The retracing of any moment of cognition will thus provide the unique artistic form of that moment. So you get the symbolism of each moment in the sensory bias of the moment. And then he says, and its art form. So I'll reread that. The retracing of any moment of cognition will thus provide the unique artistic form of that moment, and its art form coincides with its quiddity, except that the artist arrests what is otherwise fleeting. Now, isn't that incredible?
It's something that I have to read again to really wrap my brain around it.
Yeah, it's dense with anthropology, psychology, gestalt, and even his medium as a message is embedded in there.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's page 30. Maybe that was 34. Let me just check that. Just for the record, that was page 34 of Interior Landscape, the hardback version.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And that's good for bringing together the whole kind of James Joyce and citing, because I did do a few modules on literature myself, and I was amazed by how passionate that people were about the readings as compared to the language of the more grammatical, where it's more structured and you have to kind of, think differently and just going into the characters and the whole way of writing is not...
Robert, what did you say there? What are they fascinated? What's the tension, the dialectic? What is it?
There's no tension. There's no dialectic.
You were amazed at what they were fascinated by. What were they? Who was fascinated by what?
It's it's the celebration and coming together of the language and
what is the what's the it refer to? What's the celebration? It. What's it refer to?
The citing of the connection between James Joyce in a book where you go to a English literature book. When you're studying English literature, you go to the book and you look at it might be, for example, what do we study, The Great Gatsby or something like this, and then you look at the back of it. There's no bibliography in the back of the book, but you're studying a literate book, you know. But with the language, you're studying a book which is grammatical.
With the language. Are you switching topics here? With the language of The Great Gatsby?
No, I just kind of, I think I was. It was good to hear somebody who's...
finish your thought. You went and you said... There's no bibliography at the end of a fictional book. That's interesting. And then you said, with the language of what? Have you shifted to another type of book, or are you still talking more fiction?
I studied media and I studied English language, but I was lucky enough to have even more where I was doing more practical with the radio production and on a module. And
you're shifting from books to radio.
We're literature. Yeah, from the language, I ended up doing two literature modules, and the way that after 3 years of people studying literature, and there's me 3 years of studying language.
How are you studying language? That's the same as literature. What are we doing differently?
No, it's not. No, it's a big difference. Language is grammatical. It's.
Are you talking about doing radio work when you say language?
That was on the media, so the media...
Yeah, the media. What? Name the media. What were you doing?
We were doing sound bites. We were going out recording.
Sound bite, that's acoustic. So you're defining acoustic space as opposed to literary space.
No, I was defining my kind of other side of the joint, which was the English language and the English literature and the passion between...
you don't think English language is in English literature?
Every single book that was put in front of me within the literate modules were authors. You know, they were like Frankenstein books, or they were Great Gatsby, like I mentioned.
Yeah, they were books. What about them?
Whereas, with the language, you know,
with the non-book, like, with the language, even though books are language, but you're saying you're using the word language to apply to non-book.
No, Rob's making a distinction between techne and psyche, and how some literature is more like psyche, and some books are written more technically.
No, hold that off, Scott. That might be true, but I don't know if Robert knows that. What are you trying to make a distinction between, Robert?
I'm not making a distinction. I'm kind of giving an appraisal.
Of what?
The ability of Marshall McLuhan's ability to reach out to the literate and the language, because as much as he contributed to media, he contributed to language as well.
Do you know that he considered media to be language? So if you're going to talk McLuhan, you use his knowing, his terms. So you can't say media is not language. That's his main point. New media were languages. So you don't. I would suggest drop the word language to make some distinctions here.
Well, this is where my kind of my joint degree gets a bit confusing.
Hold it, Sheila. Mute Sheila. Anyways, go ahead, Robert.
I'm reminded of that kind of joy that I've seen in people's not just
what kind of joy.
You know, when you look at people and you can see them happy because they're literate people, they love
the I lived in New York for 15 more years, and a lot of literate people reading books in the subway, and I never saw so many unhappy people.
I know. I agree.
Carol knows that.
I'm agreeing.
No, but it happens in television as well. You only have to look at the popularity of soap and stuff like that, you know, soap dramas and romance.
Yeah, and what does that tell us versus books? Are you saying that the soap drama people aren't as happy as the book consumers in the London subway?
No, I think there's more uniformed and then there's more absorbed. You know, there's people who are more uniform in trying to kind of Especially with language, you know, when you look at the...
Wait. Are you talking about the book readers or the soap... Carol is saying, stop it, Bob. But look, this is media grammar. A guy is talking. We're asking him to speculate about his words.
I squeeze the lemon no matter who you're talking to.
Yeah, squeezing. We're squeezing Robert.
You've got me there because I could say that I'm the best advocate for grammar and unification, but I don't know. You got me there, Bobby.
No. I'm not trying to get you. I'm trying to get you somewhere where you see what you're – I'm trying to figure out what you're trying to say. I'm trying to match with you, Robert.
No.
I'm trying to match and see what your image is that you're projecting. You're trying to say that McLuhan was really good or joyful at what?
I think the language side of McLuhan would probably be symbolism and where you say about the...
Okay, so look
hold
at the
on,
words.
Bob, Robert, define what you mean by language. You just used the word McLuhan's language. What do you mean by language?
The more structured way of kind of bringing education into the text and the language. You know, you're trying to teach someone about the form and the, or not in the literate sense, but in the.
No, you're right, Robert. You're saying that pointing out the forms of media, of education and language and media, is more structured to you.
Yeah, it's measurable. It's a more kind of a measuring thing, isn't it? You know.
Well, that's true. That's true. McLuhan said his approach was structural. So, okay. So you're celebrating McLuhan's structural approach to language.
I'm bringing in the literate because, you know, to bring the literacy together with the two, and then...
Now note what McLuhan said. That literacy causes the lack of observation of structure, or at least it becomes a limited kind of observation of structure. That's the important insight here. McLuhan wrote, that's why Joyce had to write an unreadable book, because he wanted to use the eye to notice structure, but he couldn't do it through literary content, because that made you get obsessed with the content and miss the structure. That's why the West allowed technology, the North allowed technology to run rampant, because they'd been alphabetized and then printing press eyes, so they didn't notice the effects, whereas the Chinese and Asian non-Westernized cultures immediately saw the effects and remained futile.
Mm. Oh, my God. Would you say that again, Bob?
The Western world, because the alphabet originally out of Greece and the Holy Roman Empire, makes you look at the content of the words because you got to translate the abstract alphabetic 26 letters, which don't look like anything, you've got to make a mental translation in your mind. That's the first schizophrenia that happens to Western man, according to McLuhan. When the printing press comes along 1,000 years later and spreads that all over the place, but especially in the West, you now have from 1600 huge numbers of people visually handicapped. They cannot see the effects. And McLuhan said they were obsessed with efficient causality, quoting Aristotle, to make machines to fill up the visual container, whereas the non-alphabetized, non-printing press Asian cultures like China, they immediately saw when a new invention was brought into the culture. They killed the guy who brought the invention because they saw the structural effects of it because they weren't alphabetized. And that, again, is the key insight to get about McLuhan, is that you get into philosophy and the head trip of the West and his schizophrenia due to the fragmenting effect of the phonetic alphabet. And that explains a lot of our history, if you believe and accept that premise.
But what does unite all of them and everybody, whether it's coming from wherever, is the feminine and the feminine and the cartoon, especially in the Chinese.
Now, that's an interesting statement. Did you get that, Sheila? What unites everybody is the feminine and the cartoon. Do you know any feminists that think they're cartoons? I mean, Robert makes great surrealistic statements that you can break down and get some important insights. Just ignore what Robert means by it, but just take the words themselves. They're pretty interesting.
Well, I do spend a lot of time in Leicester Square here in London. They've got the Catholic Church there, and you go in, and you've got the lady with the sheep. What's her name? Is it
The lady with the sheep, Mary, Virgin Mary.
Yeah, it's the deity, isn't it? You know, it's the Chinese.
You spent a lot of time with that lady with the sheep. Robert is a cartoon. What do you think of that? There's a paramedia cologist goes into a church and notices not the semantic conceptual content of the Virgin Mary, just notices it's a woman with the sheep. The Lamb of God.
Well, there's a peacock there as well. Though. There's a peacock with her feet. I think there's a goat as well.
It's a zoo.
And it's a cartoon as well. I don't know if it's a stitching or something, but you know, it's a Christian thing. But there's the link between the, you know, with the archetypal. Did you mention the pagan kind of links that he makes from the historical Greek stuff and that? You know, it's a celebration.
No, here, Robert. I met Robert. He made the funniest YouTube I ever. That I was happy to be part of. We went to Hyde Park in April 2008. And we're listening to these people rant on, and I was listening to this black guy rant on against a fundamentalist Christian, and beside him was a man who couldn't speak, and he was, what, mute. It may have even been deaf, but he made these incredible facial expressions that Robert taped over my shoulder, and maybe you guys remember that. Anybody saw it?
That. Yeah, I didn't see it, but you told me about it.
Yeah, you see his face going happy, sad, as he hears the opinions being expressed. And exaggerated, it looks like the Greek, the two masks of Greek theater. But it's incredible. So Robert did that. We're forever indebted for Robert doing that, even though the YouTube was lost because Buzz was chased by the fundamentalist Christians off the YouTube, so it got lost. But we know what happened. So Robert spends his time the last few years wandering around in every kind of course in the universities there. He's a wandering gypsy, McLuhan said, that 60 students were wandering gypsies. So what you're getting from, I perceive, Robert, as a collage of all these different thought forms and jargons from different disciplines, all strung together with any reason that he can come up with to say it. Right, Robert?
It's more of a mosaic, but the last part, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. This is a person who's an information junkie, and this is what happens when you are imbibing information in all these different media in this late stage of human progress. You sound like Robert.
It's good to be able to distinguish and notice things as they change, though, and flip into all the different kinds of people, you know, because
flip into the different kinds of people. Now, you get what he's saying there? It is actually very fitting and easy to McLuhan-esque if you can suspend your critical judgment.
The downside of it is that, and Rene said it there in one of his emails today, is you know, people are losing sight of the goals, you know, and what it is they're trying
the
to
goals?
Achieve because of the distraction, you know, whether it's an email coming in or it's a Twitter message.
Yeah. Now, what you're describing, Robert, is what Joyce thought radio would do. Radio is too much information 24/7 or whatever they had in Dublin and in Paris in the 20s and 30s. It was a distraction. So you started saying, man, nobody's going to be able to pay attention. Now here it is 100 years later with, it's actually not even us. We're not being distracted. The Android meme has extended itself and it's distracting itself.
Yeah.
So the Android meme is real.
What'd you say?
Is it its own entity or is it?
Yes, yes.
Well, Bob, what you said
manifested from people's imagination.
What you just said about the Android meme has now extended itself. It's as though you're saying it's now the central character.
Yes, it
now,
imitates.
If you want to take that approach, it reminds me of Ion saying, you know, when humans put their power in outside themselves in a box. You're suggesting that we've invested our power outside of ourselves in the Android meme?
The Android meme put its power outside of itself as now a dumb Christian.
Well, where does that leave us?
Oh, where does that leave us? That's a good question, Scott. That's where we began. McLuhan writes in 1951 that humanity is totally fused and obliterated. That's 60 years ago. He came to that conclusion. There's no us to be left.
But we have actually seen a companionship with robots go into space with the Robonaut 2, you know, in the space station last week. And, like, you know, it's...
See, so Robert cites something that the machines did as a sign of hope.
that's not even what I was talking about. That's
how it was interpreted, buddy.
I got the trash robot in the kitchen one to clear the rubbish, but no, it is the mechanical bride, isn't it? I suppose if you are going to have a droid, it has to be feminine.
I'd call it the mechanical species.
Okay.
Yes, I prefer the species, please.
Yeah, what did you just do, Carol? What were you nodding at? What did he say? He said that? The mechanical feminine robot? Yeah. That McLuhan said that the mechanical bride was a product of the hot media of movie, radio, and print and newspaper. But television brought in the throwaway jujube. And women thought that was women's liberation. McLuhan said the television had the mechanical bride step off her pedestal and join in the tribal dance, beginning with the twist and rock and roll. And so... all our anthropomorphic women were expendable jujubes. But then the satellite came along and made everybody feel powerful and do their own things. The women thought that they were empowered, and they started declaring their sovereign women's liberation tribe. And on it goes, and then the Android meme replayed it. All the issues that we're discussing that McLuhan discusses, to wrap this up, McLuhan was the last writer about the history of the global village, and then the Android meme replayed all that McLuhan wrote about. And that's why Wired magazine made McLuhan the patron saint. It was the Android meme celebrating the guy who was the last human to describe the process that the media missed the message, and then the Android meme implemented it.
Android meme is a describing word. It's not an entity then.
No, it's an entity. It's an entity. It's the implosion of the media that Andrew began with at the beginning of this a couple hours ago. So, actually, Andrew and I have to go to a meeting, so we're going to bow out. You guys can keep talking. This line is open to everybody forever. So I'm going to stop the recording. Anybody want to say how much they've enjoyed themselves?
Yeah, this is awesome forum.
Yeah. There are a few things
really fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll be back next week. We'll do this as much as possible every week, and we'll try to – everybody recommend somebody that we might be able to bring in and present some thesis, and then we talk about it. We say the jest of honor because that was the secret term at the Monday Night Seminar. McLuhan always had guests, but the secret attitude was, if you were on the inside, was it was the jest of honor. Because if you were invited by McLuhan to present something, you'd probably get real serious and practice and rehearse it, and then you'd come in and sit down and start presenting it, and it – inevitably got torn apart after 5 minutes. No one ever got to present their thing very long. The jest of honor. So,
anyway, Bob, what is it you presented today just as a kind of a conclusion?
You what did you say?
What you said at the beginning you had something really important to present, and what was it? Which part was it?
It was this whole 2 hours or whatever it's been. It was you guys. That was the important thing to present.
Robert, you are priceless.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm honored to be priceless.
No. Robert. Yes, Bob, you are too, but Robert.
That's right. That's the only reason we'd put up with him, is that
he's
priceless.
Amazing. He's priceless.
Yeah, I mean, Bob, don't you notice something about Robert that there's this part that you hear as being sort of random access discombobulation, and yet... And yet there's a kind of an integrity under the surface, something that's constant there also.
Yeah, it's the stages of human apprehension. It's a very creative process itself, uttering itself.
Very good, very good.
Okay, is Andrew still around? Okay, anyways, Carolyn, you'll have to disconnect so I can – we can only have one person on the phone. No, everybody stay here. I just want to stop the recording. I'm just going to hit *90, and it should stop. Okay, let's see if it works. Oh, didn't work. Okay, let's try again. Hmm. What do you think, Carol? You're off. You sure?
Yep.
Okay. Star 9. Well, it'll stop on its own if we disconnect, I assume. It has before. Like, there's... What do I need? See, that's where I came in. I'm hooked into your guys' network through what Brian has done. May, but I did start it, right?
I don't know if that's an answerable question, Bob.
Yeah. Anyways, okay, we should, I don't know.
It said
how
it was recording
it
when I came back in.
Say goodnight, Bob. Goodnight, Bob.
Goodnight,
yeah.
Bob.
Hey, Bob, are we going to use the same numbers next week?
Yeah, it, usually that doesn't matter, Carol, the speaker, but...
Are we,
so what...
Are we
just a second, guys. I think we figured it out. It could be the speakerphone. I have to disconnect that. Usually I don't have to, but let's see. Just hold on, everybody. Turn this off. And now...
Okay, good night, everyone. Thanks for your nice call.